This is Matt Freitas, and you're listening to the Late Night History Podcast. Tonight, we have a returning guest who first appeared on Episode 8, Delta Force OG Mike Vining. The first half of the show covers Explosive Ordnance Disposal, or EOD, and its history from World War II up until Vietnam. Next, Mike shares his experiences in combat in Vietnam and in Cambodia, including doing similar work as the famous tunnel rats once did, which included crawling into small tunnels armed with only flashlights, pistols, and in Mike's case, explosives. After that, we explore EOD history regarding Delta Force, as well as some of the lesser-known ordnance employed in the Middle East, like various types of bunker buster bombs, some with even funny nicknames, like Cheeseburger. Towards the end, Mike covers the different organizations he is involved with and the donation of his uniform to a museum. To support this podcast, please leave a 5-star review on Apple or subscribe on Spotify. Doing so might seem minor, but the reviews and subscriptions are important metrics that allow me to keep interviewing world-class guests. This episode will also be accompanied by a short 5-minute clip on YouTube, which I'll link in the description. So here is episode 38. All right, so I'm sitting here with Mike Vining. Mike is a returning guest. He appeared on episode 8, and we discussed mostly the types of operations that he participated in while he was in the U.S. Army, and specifically in Delta Force. But tonight, we are focusing heavily on the history of Explosive Ordnance Disposal, or EOD. So, Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me back, Matt. I'm quite excited about covering the history of the U.S. military explosive ordnance disposal. Before it was known by that name, or EOD, it was just called bomb disposal. And so they decided to change the name following World War II to explosive ordnance disposal, because mostly what we did in World War II was other kinds of, you know, booby traps, any dud munitions. Bombs were less than 25% of what we did during World War II, the rendering safe and disposing of dropped bombs and such. So, yeah, EOD, it formally kicked off in 1942. But I'm going to go back into history a little bit before we had a formal career field in the U.S. military, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, dedicated to the rendering safe of unexploded ordnance, you know, clearing hazards such as booby traps, IEDs that they're known today, and stuff. What happened before this usually was the responsibility of the engineer corps. Before World War II, the cleanup of dud munitions, ordnance was a task given to the engineer corps. During this American Civil War, when we were using ordnance such as projectiles, they were black powder, filled with black powder, not a high explosives. And of course, battlefields were littered with unexploded ordnance. They were simple type of munitions. They either had a powder train type time fuse, they had a percussion fuse that would function on impact, and they started to develop actually time fuse, powder train time fuse, like the Bormann time fuse, where you could actually select what time you wanted the shell to go off. During this American Civil War, after a battle had been field and a lot of dud ordnance littered the battlefield, and particularly in the South, they would collect all this dud ordnance and actually recycle it. They would extract the black powder out of the shells, the sulfur that held the mini balls that were inside of the shrapnel shells. And because the South short of resources and stuff, so they need short of black powder and other things. So they actually collected the stuff from the battlefield and repurposed it. Then World War I came about, and the battlefields of the continental Europe was littered with dud ordnance. In Europe, after World War I, some of the countries, and in particularly I know Luxembourg, actually formalized bomb disposal or EOD following World War I into their military to clean up the battlefields of Europe from World War I, which they're still cleaning up today. But it wasn't until World War II, with the Battle of Britain in 1940, where the Germans were dropping ordnance all over Great Britain. Now, the Germans first developed a particular type of fuse in the 1930s, and it was electric fuse. Had that it would be charged by the aircraft. It had a condenser that actually held the charge, and it would function by either impact, or they could set the delay up to 72 hours for the bomb to function. So they developed this fuse. They even offered it in the 1930s to Great Britain, but Great Britain wasn't interested in it. But what the Germans learned during the Spanish Civil War, that unexploded ordnance has more of a psychological effect than when ordnance actually goes off. So, if you drop, say, a bunch of bombs on a railroad marshaling yard, and the bombs all detonate and they destroy the tracks and everything, they can go out immediately, fill the holes in, repair the rails, and get those trains moving. But if they have bombs that can go off anytime between now and 72 hours, the crews aren't going to be out there to repair the tracks and everything. And so the Germans were using these types of fuses. So Great Britain needed to get these trains rolling and get things up and going on. So they developed a bomb disposal unit in their military, in their army. They took officers that had, engineering backgrounds, and particularly in the ammunition field, and set up bomb disposal companies. The British Navy did the same thing with mine disposal, sea mines, and everything. And sometimes they cross-trained on that. This was what's going on in Europe. And of course, we're watching what's going on in Europe, because sooner or later we're going to get involved. So for the Navy, I'll tell you about the Navy. There was a lieutenant. He was a Academy graduate. His name was Draper Kaufman. He graduated from the Naval Academy, but didn't get a commission in the Navy because of his eyesight. So a lot of Americans, before we got involved in the war, went over to Great Britain and volunteered, their services. And so he served in the British Naval Reserves, and he was trained as a mine disposal and bomb disposal during the Battle of Britain. So, when we started to knew that it was going, we're going to get involved in World War II, they brought him back and commissioned him as an officer to set up at the Navy Bomb Disposal School. So Draper Kaufman, later Rear Admiral, is basically what's considered the father of Navy bomb disposal. So, but also at the same time with the US Navy in 1941, they set up a Navy mine disposal school. And later on, of course, the mine disposal and bomb disposal merged together. But initially, during World War II, they were separate. And a lot of times they were stationed together. So the first class of Navy mine disposal They graduated in 1941, and there were three Coast Guard members in that class, and that's the only time Coast Guard attended either school. But in the first class, there happened to be three Coast Guard members that attended. And then in 1942, the Navy, in March, the Navy graduated its first class, and there was four Army guys in the Navy's class that attended the Navy Bomb School, and it was at the American University. They later moved their bomb disposal school to the Washington Naval Yard. At the same time, for the Army, we sent nine officers over to England before we got involved in World War II to learn the art of bomb disposal. And one of those was an officer named Thomas Kane. And he is considered the father of army bomb disposal. So after these nine army officers went to England, they came back to Aberdeen Proving Grounds and set up the U.S. Army Bomb Disposal School. So, and the two schools, Army Bomb Disposal and Navy Bomb Disposal, shared a lot of intelligence information back and forth. And of course, Army Bomb Disposal guys from Great Britain came over and helped with the first class. So it was a joint effort, both between US Navy and US Army and Great Britain. And of course, World War II happened on December 7th, 1941. So for the Army,
One
go
thing I
ahead.
wanted to add, Mike, was Draper Kaufman, after the Pearl Harbor attacks, he was awarded the Navy Cross for I think defusing unexploded ordnance.
Yes, he was for defusing a bomb that the Japanese had dropped on her. He was not the actual. There's a little mistake in history that he defused the first bomb, enemy bomb in after Pearl Harbor. It was a gentleman who was a civilian, an ammunition officer, a civilian. He actually defused that bomb. Now, Draper Kaufman, they went and took apart the fuse, the Japanese fuse, but the fuse was already separated from the bomb. But yes, he was awarded the Navy Cross for, and that was his first Navy Cross. He later was awarded another Navy Cross, so he had two of them. That's pretty good. Yeah, thank you for adding that. Well, Draper Kaufman set up the school. So in the first class, the Army graduated a few days before the Navy class did their first class, but it was all basically in 1942, in March of 42. The first graduating class, Army-wise, became the instructors for the pre follow-on classes.
What
Back then, for rendering safe bombs and ammunition was the responsibility of officers. That's how the British had set it up. The enlisted would be like the sappers, they would be called. They would go, if the bomb was, 15 feet in the ground, they would actually dig down to the bomb, the enlisted would. They would put chaffing material, wooden framework, to keep the ground from collapsing. And once the bomb was exposed, the officer would go down and render it safe. The enlisted would prepare the tools, and they would stand by. And in later cases, they would have a microphone set up so the officer could tell a recorder who was in a safe area what he was doing. And if if he was saying, "I was removing this plate," and the device exploded, well, they would know that there was something might be underneath that plate that caused the device to explode. So, as the war, World War II developed, And the officers would train their senior NCOs in render safe procedures. For the Army, for the enlisted during World War II, it was not really deemed a career field. Bomb disposal was. Now, officers that went through officer training and enlisted training in bomb disposal school was two different classes. They weren't together in the same class. In the Navy, the enlisted and officers were in the same class, but Army, we separated them. And then upon graduation, you would get a red sleeve, red bomb insignia to put on your uniform to say that you were bomb disposal. Now, that was a permanent award for officers, but in the Army, for the enlisted, you wore the bomb disposal patch while you were assigned to a bomb disposal unit. When you left that unit, say you went to an ammunition company, you had to remove it. So it was at that time, it wasn't really considered permanent field. And of course, the training officers received a lot more training in the render safe and stuff. And again, the listed were the rigging and digging, hoisting, being able to maintain the tools and equipment, prepare all that. And that was mainly what the enlisted were. Enlisted were trained to recognize ordnance, the different types of ordnance, and the hazards associated with that ordnance. But render safe was given just to training was given to the officers.
And when the U.S. Army guys, when they graduated from that the schoolhouse, did they go to like one specific Army unit, or were they like attached to different units?
Well, initially for the Army, we set up EOD companies. We set up two in the very beginning. We had two EOD companies that we set up, and we basically modeled it after Britain, how Great Britain was doing it. But they, at that time, they were only operating in England. We had not gone into continental Europe yet. So that's how they were kind of organized. And, but as we went into the war, it was the companies were broke down to platoons separate. And shortly after that, the companies were broken down to squads separate. So we had seven-man bomb disposal squads, separate, is what they were called, that operated throughout Europe and then in the Pacific theater because we had to be, because of the vast territory, and we had to be spread out more. We would have to be with the maneuver units that were maneuvering, and some of the Army units were assigned to the Army Air Corps, so like the Ninth Air Force. So they in Europe, they worked under the Ninth Air Force. And that's basically the forerunner of Air Force EOD was the Army Air Corps and Army Air Force. So we operated spread out, you know, and some units stayed in the rear. The theater rear to clean up all the debris. There might, you know, enemy ammunition depots that had now been occupied and to destroy the enemy ammunition. But then others were out with maneuver units in the forefront of battle. And so that's how we operated. The Navy especially operated. There was Navy in France too. There was Navy involved in D-Day. And we, so we had some Navy in Europe, but the big play for the Navy and for the Marine Corps was in the Pacific Theater. Now, a couple months after, on the third Navy bomb disposal class was the first Marine Corps people that entered the bomb disposal. So that was like in July of 1942. Two when they had the first Marines graduate from the Navy bomb disposal. And so they, you know, they operated in the Pacific theater. Now, what they did on aircraft carriers, there was usually one Navy officer, bomb disposal officer, assigned to an aircraft carrier, and to take care of any problems that on board the aircraft. Maybe, a bomb fell off the rack of an aircraft, and or they were bombed or shelled, and the projectile didn't go off, or the bomb didn't go off. So there was one officer on aircraft carriers. And in a lot of cases, Navy mine disposal and bomb disposal teams worked together in the Pacific Theater. And that was pretty much World War II. Is there any questions?
One thing was going back to Draper Kaufman, he organized the Naval Combat Demolition Units, and I
He
know they
did.
were involved at the beaches of Normandy. But I think one, like, I know a little bit, like, that's one of my main interests is naval special warfare, and the NCDUs, they were really active at Omaha Beach, but who get, often gets overlooked is the Army EOD, like the bomb disposal guys who were also serving alongside and helped clear the beaches as well.
Yeah, and there was also Army Combat Engineers that were there too. Yeah, Draper Coffin, after he set up the Navy Bomb Disposal School, he was tasked to set up the Navy Combat Diver School down at Fort Pierce, Florida. And so here's an officer that first the Navy didn't want him because of his poor eyesight, and now he's setting up the Navy combat divers, and they were involved in the European theater. And the underwater demolition teams were involved in the Pacific theater. And then there was Navy bomb disposal officers that actually volunteered to be Navy combat divers and went through that training. So they were both qualified. Yeah. That's an important part. The EOD school today the school's named after him, the schoolhouse in honor of him. So following World War II, not in 1947, of course, Department of Defense was formed, the Air Force were formed, and the Air Force started sending their bomb techs to the schools, to EOD. And it was at that time that, well, I think it was around 1951, Department of Defense made the Navy the proponent of EOD training. Now we still had Army, we still had our school at Fort at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. The Navy moved into Indian Head, Maryland, the Naval Ordnance Station, or it was also known as Naval Powder Station back then. So they moved their school in there. So it took a while before the Army moved into the Navy. By 1956, I think it was totally merged. The Army was merged in with the Navy at Indian Head, Maryland. The enlisted training was took it was the last group to be merged in. And at that point, all whether you're an officer or enlisted, you have the same common training. And so that was the important thing of the EOD school at Indian Head, Maryland. For the Army, another point for the Army following World War II is that the Army didn't think they had a need for bomb disposal people after World War II. So they stopped they basically stopped the training at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. They were still offering it as a correspondent course. You could get a Somehow there was a correspondent course. But we set up a school inside of Germany, and we set up a school in Tokyo following World War II to train people bomb disposal or explosive ordnance disposal to clean up the battlefields and all the stockpiles of ammunition that was left over from the war and everything. So we did have those two separate schools there located in Germany and Japan. But then it was shortly realized a couple of years later that we needed to keep a formal bomb disposal school at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. I don't know, I guess they thought all that stuff would go away. And as you know, that stuff's still being found today from World War I, World War II. We're still digging up Civil War ordnance. A hurricane would come in and wash the beaches, and there would be a bunch of Civil War projectiles laying on the beach. So even from our American Civil War. But it was very greatly reduced, the bomb disposal school. And then Korea happened. Now, Korea was kind of a surprise to everybody. We were not prepared for Korea. The invasion of North Korea into South Korea. So what we and mostly in the army, the bomb disposal squads were, or at this time they were explosive ordnance disposal detachments. They were reserve. They weren't active duty. And so Korea happened. So both the Marines and the Army were short of qualified EOD people to support the Korean theater. So the Army set up a school there in Seoul, Korea. The 24th EOD control set up a 2-week school. So to fill the shortages in Korea, both the Marines and the Army would solicit volunteers in theater, people like in the ammunition companies, to volunteer for EOD, and they'd go through the 2-week class in Korea. And the rest they would learn on the job. And that's how, because Korea was like an emergency situation. And so that's how Korea went. Both the Marines and Army, they did 2-week in-country training. We still had those that were through a formal school. And then we move into Vietnam, the year 1965. So we started sending a few EOD detachments. We sent them over to Vietnam, South Vietnam, to support the theater there. The 533rd EOD control, the 170th Ordnance Detachment that was in Saigon. At first, the 533rd was in Saigon. They moved out to Long Binh. And eventually, now in the Army, for example, EOD. We were in detachments. It was a 10-man detachment back then. And eventually, at the high point of the Vietnam War for the Army, we had 15 EOD detachments, counting a control detachment in Vietnam. If I'll explain the Army before I explain the other services. How we operated in Vietnam is that we operated in geographical areas. So, where you supported any operating unit that was in your area, you weren't assigned. We weren't assigned to a division or anything. Now, at early on, we did have two senior enlisted assigned to every combat division. There was always two to take care of the needs of the division, maybe to go out to cl help clear a range so that they can put targets in. And then we had EOD over in Vietnam as advisors to the South Vietnamese, their counterpart. They sent people to our EOD school, the South Vietnamese did. And today we still have a lot of foreign students that go through the EOD program. So at Eglin, now I got it right, Eglin Air Force Base. Sorry, Eglin. So, like, I'll give an example. I was with the 99th Ordnance Detachment, EOD, in Vietnam. So our geographical area was Three Corps, the northwest corner of Three Corps. So any unit that operated in this area, we supported. So we supported all of 1st Cav Division, Air Mobile at the time, operations, and they operate exclusively in our geographical area. And we are part of the 1st Infantry Division that crossed over into our area, the 199th Light Infantry Brigade, and the 11th Armored Cav Regiment. So we supported all those units when they would call us if they had found a bomb in the middle of a jungle. And of course, we need to take care of these dud bombs because we don't want the enemy to repurpose them. The enemy would take and they would turn them into booby traps, roadside bombs, later called, would be known as IEDs today. Or they would actually take saws, cut the bomb in two, and then using sledgehammers, beat out the explosives and repurpose the explosives. So, we did not want any of this stuff to fall into enemy hands. So a unit would call us in if they moved in on a bunker complex. We would be before they would move into this bunker complex, we would come in and we would help clear it of any booby traps. They would do such things as put a 105 in a tree, suspended in a tree, and they could command detonate the 105 projectile from inside the bunker. That kind of stuff. And they would find caches of enemy ammunition, and then we would destroy it. So that's how we operated. So whatever requesting unit needed EOD, they would send a helicopter to us to get on to go in and support them, or we drive by vehicle truck if that was possible. That's how we did it in the Army. Of course, the Navy, was the big maritime, making sure, enemy divers are not planting a limpet-type charge on a ship to keep the harbors clear of enemy things. Anything that washed up on the shores, Navy EOD, Navy supported all their operations and pretty much doing a lot of things that the Army was doing. And we worked together. The Army, Navy worked together. The Marine Corps were mostly involved in Marine Corps operations, Marine Corps aircraft, just pretty much supported the Marine Corps. And the Air Force did the same thing, supported the airfields, and used sometimes, their aircraft, if they would go down, it'd be their responsibility. Sometimes if we're the nearest unit, we would go on in on a down aircraft. And that's basically, they always say anything below the high tide is the Navy, anything above the high tide is Army. So, if we didn't want to work on something, we just moved it down below the high tide, and now we call the Navy. And the Air Force just operated with their component, and the Marines operated with their component. And that was Vietnam when the last units left Vietnam. And I think it was, well, we still had some units operate supporting. Even the Air Force did too. The JRC, the Joint Recovery Program. So we had some that would go in there. And after the peace treaty of 1973, that we would, the agreement was that we would have specially marked helicopters and we would still try to recover some of our missing soldiers and sailors and airmen and all that. So we operated with that because of, any hazardous ordnance that needed to be dealt with. And that was Vietnam. And
You were awarded the Bronze Star in Vietnam. Was that for like the bunker complex?
now, Bronze Star was just for my time in Vietnam for service. I got the Bronze Star for service, not any particular act, but yeah. During May of June of 1970, President Nixon authorized us to go into Cambodia, the sanctuary zones, and what we're doing is that we're trying to set the Vietnamese up to success. There was the Vietnamization program, where, in 1970, we wanted to start slowly turn the war over to the South Vietnamese. And in order to set them up for success, it was deemed that we would go into these sanctuary zones and just destroy whatever we could destroy in the sanctuary zone. So yeah, my team, well, I was on an eight-man team that was at Rock Island East. It was called named after Rock Island, Illinois, the arsenal in Illinois. That was the largest enemy weapons and ammunition cache destroyed in the Vietnam War. There was over 320 tons estimated of weapons and ammunition. We destroyed, we actually blew up about 79 tons of that ammunition. A lot of the weapons and stuff was backhauled. So yeah, we used, I think, close to 300 cases of C4, 12 cases of detonating cord to blow Rock Island East up. And that was the largest. The second largest cache site in the Vietnam War, again in Cambodia, was the city. The city was a, it wasn't the notorious Cosvin. Everybody was wanting Cosvin, the rear headquarters of the North Vietnamese Army that's supposed to be located in Cambodia. But the city was like that. It was, it had schoolhouses training set up, it had barracks, it had motor pool maintenance, it had a hospital, it had an ammunition depot, and that so it was named the city. And I did wasn't involved in the city, the destruction of the city. Other EOD teams were. And then the third largest was Warehouse Hill. Warehouse Hill was all underground. There was a ridge dug in. I think there was like 15 tunnel entrances that were ammunition that were inside in the ridge and tunnels and stuff like that. And so I was part of a four-man EOD team that blew Warehouse Hill up. There was two of us that actually went into the tunnels and carried the explosives and set everything up. I was not very big. I mean, I'm 5'6", weighed 120 some pounds, so I fit perfectly in the tunnel.
Were the tunnels
Yeah.
like the same, like the infamous tunnel rats? Was it like those types of tunnels, or were they?
I went into several tunnels in Vietnam. You know, like this one tunnel, they uncovered the tunnel and the office officer tried to enter the tunnel. And of course, they kicked it down some dirt when he entered the tunnel, but it was booby-trapped and an explosive device went off, but it was kind of buried under the dirt. And so he was actually blown out of the tunnel and had to be medevaced out. And of course, then nobody wanted to go into the tunnel. So we were called in. There was two of us. And I went down into the tunnel and it was full of bicycles. There was a lot of bicycles in there. There was cans of there was medical equipment in there, medical stuff, supplies. There was petroleum cans of fuel that were in there for their trucks. They still, you know, they ran trucks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail sometimes. There's fuel cans in there. So I set all that up to blow up. I went down a few tunnels, I guess when nobody else wanted to do it. The famous tunnel rats were with the 25th, you know, if you read the tunnels of Cu Chi, they were with the 25th Infantry Division. A lot of them were chemical corps that went down in for whatever reason, became the tunnel rats for the 25th Infantry Division. But we did that too. We went down lots of tunnels. It's you go down in there, a lot of times it's full of critters. I mean, there was scorpions, there were spiders, there were poisonous centipedes, there were cave crickets, And there was even bats down in the tunnel. Like one time, a whole group of bats flew over the top of me and made my heart skip a beat. That kind of stuff. So never saw any snakes in the tunnel. But there's a lot of that insect. The centipedes were poisonous. They would secrete, they weren't a poison, they didn't sting or anything. They secreted a poison. Wherever they would touch you would form blisters. And they had some big, scorpions, about 7 inches big.
What did you
And
carry?
so,
Did you have like a flashlight, a gun, explosives?
yeah, you carried the flashlight, and you just carried a pistol, 45. That was about it. And then, you'd discover what's down in the tunnel, and you come up and discuss what needs to be done, and how many cases of C4 I need to bring down into the tunnel to set it up and blow it up. But yeah, that
And were you
was
like
Vietnam.
crawling into the tunnel?
Yeah, the tunnels were, the ground in Vietnam is a soil that's called laterite. Laterite is kind of a mix between a clay and a rock. It's very good for carving. The tunnels were, arch curved. They would have a trench down the center of them for, water and stuff like that. They were well shaped, well constructed tunnels, the perfect medium to construct. And the thing about laterite is if a bomb lands nearby, the ground shock, the laterite is elastic. It compresses. So it doesn't go to cave in the tunnel in. It can be a close bomb, but it won't cave the tunnel in just because of the elasticity of the laterite. It's a kind of a clay rock type thing. Perfect for digging tunnels. And of course, in tunnels of the story about Cu Chi and the fire support base at Cu Chi, underneath it was riddled with tunnels. I mean, they started digging tunnels in World War II. World War II, Vietnam was occupied by the Japanese. I'm getting off track, but anyway, we sent the OSS people and the British sent SOE people into Vietnam during World War II and worked with the Viet Minh fighting the Japanese. And Ho Chi Minh was a U.S. OSS agent during the Vietnam War. A lot of people don't know that, but he worked for the U.S. during World War II. But that's it. And I can move on to modern day.
Before you do, do you know when like the technology started to like the bomb suits, the robots, is that more modern day or is that back maybe, I don't know, like the 80s, 90s?
It started, I never wore a bomb suit, never operated a robot. That started to become into being, I'd say in the 1990s. Well, we might have been had war robots in the 80s, probably, but those were very primitive robots, and we just didn't think too much. I mean, yeah, if an explosive device goes off, if a 500-pound bomb goes off and you're defusing it and you're right there, that bomb suit's not going to do anything. My first 500-pound bomb I did in Vietnam, I remember that. It was in the middle of a fire support base that had there was an airstrike before that. It was a fire support base, and they found three bombs that hadn't exploded, and they set up the 105s and they set up the perimeter. And then they discovered the bombs. So we had to defuse by hand the bombs. There was only really two that we defused. The other one had gone deep into the ground and detonated underground and didn't crater the surface. And that's known as a camouflage. But yeah, a lot of times we kind of used it as more of a hindrance. And then it came down to there's official policy that you would have to use them. I never put on a bomb suit once, never even operated a robot. That was later. And, I don't know. I can't say, how many lives a bomb suit saved. Robots are sure, and especially the stuff is better technology-wise, is better than what we had back then. The comfort of a bomb suit, what the ability of the robots today can do, just a lot better technology. But yeah, we were old school.
And then EO, so after Vietnam, of course you became one of the original EOD members of Delta Force.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, when they set up the first Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta Airborne, known as Delta Force, Colonel Beckwith, Charlie Beckwith, was in charge of that. He had a vision. He had spent time with the British SAS, and he liked what they were doing, and with counterterrorism and everything. And he thought that we needed to set up a counterterrorist unit in the United States, similar online with the British SAS. And so one of the things, with terrorism and everything is IEDs and stuff. So it was Colonel Beckwith's vision to recruit six EOD NCOs to be operators and be in the unit. And so, I got the telephone call. The sergeant major at our control detachment called me. He says, "Mike, they're forming this new unit at the in Fort Bragg. They're looking for six NCOs. Some with, if you had preferred with combat experience." So I made the call. I think it was 2 days later. I was in Fort Bragg, sitting in front of Colonel Beckwith, being interviewed, and went through the interview process, and then I was selected to go through OTC one, the first operating training course. There was five EOD in the first operating training course, and only two of us made it through, myself and Dennis Wolf. OTC two, there were five EOD people in that. Only one person made it through, and that was Irvin Banna. And then we had also, they had, we hadn't gone through selection assessment. And there was actually another guy, Bob Daly, made it through. Bob didn't complete selection and assessment. So one of the requirements was, even though we went through operating training course, we're kind of doing this backwards. We had to go to the sec selection assessment course, and we had to pass it. And so we did. Now, it took me two times. I went to the first selection assessment course, I didn't pass. And then 2 weeks later, they were operating the next one, and they were running two back to back. And I passed the second one. So we had three EOD people that went through OTC and selection assessment. Then we all had to go to jump school. Now, Irvin and I did our jump school at Fort Bragg. The 7th Special Forces Group was running a jump school, so I went through their jump school. And then we had to be, then later on, it was a requirement that everybody had to be HALO qualified, so went through HALO school. And that was it. Now, Beckwith's vision was six, and we only had three that made it through the course. So we had three E7 Special Forces engineers, and they agreed to volunteer for EOD school. But to go through EOD school, you can't be above the rank of E5. And these guys were three E7s. So we made a deal with the EOD school that they would send them through the school as E5s, would make them E5s, and that they would not be awarded the MOS, and they would not be awarded the EOD badge. And of course, that was the agreement with the school. They would be our assistants, you know. So I was, you know, Irvin was at with A Squadron, and he had Bill Wilderman as his assistant. I was in, I was A Squadron. I was with B Squadron. I had Frank McKenna as my assistant. Dennis was in selection and training, and he had Phil Hansen as his assistant. So we had those guys. So we did make the six. Now, in 1986, we decided to set up a. Now, our duty MOSs were infantry, 11B. We did not have, you know, even though our primary MOS was 55 Delta EOD at that time. Later, 89, it was changed to 89 Delta as EOD, but back then it was 55 Delta. We were serving in 11B duty positions. But 1986, we set up six EOD slots, and we recruited six EOD people to have an EOD's direct support section in there. So that was 1986. Now, for what's going on in EOD, we started to reorganize, not in detachment, 10-man detachments. We reorganized in EOD in the Army, EOD companies. And you had, and they had EOD battalion, then you had the EOD group. And then, like, then you had the 20th Seaborne Command was set up at Aberdeen Proving Grounds to oversee all the EOD tech escort, all that stuff. The, you know, the chemical, biological, radiological, explosive, basically weapons of mass destruction kind of stuff. And so we set up that. Then the Gulf War happened, and EOD operated during the Gulf War. Then the current conflict, global war on terrorism, Afghanistan, and Iraq. We moved about 1999. Well, first we set up the EOD Memorial Wall in Indian Head, Maryland, in 1970. And then when we moved the EOD school down to Eglin Air Force Base, we set redid a whole new EOD Memorial Wall down at Eglin. And today that we have 344 names on the EOD Memorial. The first Saturday in May is recognized by Congress is National EOD Day. On the first Saturday in May is when we remember those 344 names on the memorial. And if we have to add any new names to the memorial, it goes on that. And we're constantly, even historically, at going back into our history and finding that we have, you know, missed some people that should be on the memorial from World War II in Korea. When we set the memorial up in 1970, did the best that we could back research. And right now, I propose to the Navy one new name to be added next year in 2024 from. He was killed on August 25th, 1944, in France by a German mine. And I did 3 years of research. All I knew is this individual was killed, and he graduated the Navy Bomb Disposal School. I knew what class he graduated in. I knew he was killed in action, but I could not determine his death. And now I have found the reason why he was killed. It was by a German mine. So I've given that to the Navy for review and to see for a possible addition. I have 60 names I have researched for the Army for historically. Now I know that some of them aren't going to meet the criteria for the placement on the name on the memorial. We have a strict criteria, but I just re You know, I was giving a research that came across their names, and then I researched the cause of death. And So we have it as a record, say 20, 30 years, somebody will say, well, how come this person's not on the EOD memorial? We can go back and say, well, didn't meet the criteria, and I can give examples of what, why this person might not meet the criteria. He wasn't doing anything related to bomb disposal at the time of his death. He was assigned to a bomb disposal, but this person was determined to be murdered by somebody that wanted the truck in Italy, stole the, So they found his body in a lake, and they stole the truck. They had a party, a dance. He was bringing the Italian girls back to the village, and he never showed up back. And then the truck was never found, for example. So that doesn't, he wasn't at that, doing anything related to EOD's cause of death. Also, we have different organizations today. We have the EOD Warrior Foundation, who supports EOD families, EOD Gold Star families. They support the maintenance on the EOD memorial. They offer scholarships to EOD people, to their children, and to their grandchildren, even are qualified for scholarship. The EOD retreats and stuff. The EOD Warrior Foundation does so much for the EOD community, and I work with them. I do the historical EOD research that when they request it. Then you have the National EOD Association, open to all four services. It's even open to public safety, law enforcement, bomb disposal. People can join the National EOD Association, because a lot of public law enforcement bomb disposal people are former, had served in bomb EOD in the military. And so the Navy has the Navy EOD Association. The Air Force also has the Master Blaster Association. So we have these different organizations.
And you're also, you said offline that you're donating your uniform to a museum. Can you talk about that?
I got a request if I would asked if I would donate my Class A uniform to the Ordnance Corps museum. So I talked to my family, talked to my wife and my two daughters, and they thought it was a fantastic idea. So today I signed the paperwork to donate my uniform to the Ordnance Museum. It'd be at Fort Gregg Adams, formerly Fort Lee in Virginia. The Ordnance Museum falls under the U.S. Army Museum at Fort Belvoir and the Center for Military History. Center for Military History has to approve my donation, that it's worthy for collection. And then I guess they're going to put it on a mannequin in the museum, which is, to me, a great honor to be asked to donate my uniform, because, what am I going to do with it? So, yeah, that's a recent development. We're building an EOD Heritage Museum at Eglin Air Force Base. I'm on the committee for that. It's going to be at the U.S. Air Force Army Museum, which is a fantastic museum, and it's free. There's a donation box. It's on Eglin, but it is outside the fence. It's right next to a main highway, and I recommend to going there. The Air Force Army Museum built four modern style, large Quonset hut type buildings on their property, and they have given one of them to us. So we are creating what's called an EOD Heritage Museum. You go in there, the goal is to be able to see a film about the history of EOD. And then to go through the exhibits, you go through the World War II, all Korea, Vietnam, Global War, Gulf War, Global War and conflict, Cold War, And then we all have an exhibit that area that changes. What our goal is to put something new every 6 months. So students that go through the school, the EOD school there at Eglin, then will tour the Heritage Museum, learn a little bit about those that had come, that served 81 years before them and how it came to be where they are now. So that's another thing that we've got going on.
That's all amazing and excited to hear. And I also want to go to that's like a bucket list or a goal of mine is to go to those museums. And it'll be cool maybe like in the future to see your uniform there.
Yeah. I hope that they, right now the Ordnance Museum is not really set up as open to the public, but it's open to s students. And I hope that, it would, they will eventually. We used to have a first-class Ordnance Museum at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. It was great. I went there several times. They just got so much stuff. I guess it's all a matter of funding and money to. It costs money to build museums. Our EOD Heritage Museum, we're starting to set up display cases and stuff like that. But that all, and we got to meet so, codes like fire marshal codes and all that kind of stuff. So in the museum, our museum, the Heritage Museum, we're going to have d the different generations of robots in the down the aisle in the center. We're going to have the different generations of bomb suits hanging over them. That's the vision. That kind of stuff. Now that it's going to be not a, I tell people it's not going to be an ordnance museum. We're not going to have all the different types of ammunition, grenades, rockets, and stuff like that. It's going to be, we'll have our tools and equipment, and it might have a bomb there with a fuse and a tool that's on that fuse to show how the relationship where the tool and how it works. But it's going to be that kind of stuff that's to tell the story, because the Armament Museum, it has a lot of that hardware type stuff, munitions and everything. And yeah, there's a lot of great museums. The Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, is a great museum. They have a Blue 82, 15,000 pound bomb there on display. It's one of only two 15,000 pound bombs. Now in Vietnam, we called them cheeseburgers. The Daisy Cutter was the 10,000 pound bomb left over from World War II. So we called that the Daisy Cutter. And for some reason, we called the 15,000 pound bomb the cheeseburger. But during the Gulf War, the name was changed to Daisy Cutter. And also, they dropped a few of these there during in Afghanistan. But there's only two left in existence. One of them is at the museum, the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio. The other one is at Fort Bliss, outside the EOD unit there at Fort Bliss. So there's two of those.
That's super interesting. I had Bill Walter. He was an AC-130 gunship gunner,
I know
and
Bill.
oh yeah, I had him on the podcast as well. And he told the story of the what came after the Blue 82 is the mother of all bombs, which was pretty
Yes,
cool.
the mother of all bombs, the MOAB, the Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb. Bill was the person responsible for saving that Blue 82 that's in the Dayton Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio. Bill's responsible for saving it. Yeah, Bill's a great guy. We communicate all the time. Yeah. And another note, a little known fact is the T-12 bomb, the Super Cloudbuster bomb. That was a 43,000 pound bomb that we developed at the end of World War II. There are only three T-12 bombs in existence today. One of them is at Fort Gregg Adams. There, it's in the middle of a traffic circle, standing with nose down in the center of the traffic circle. If you want to see a 43,000 pound bomb, the other T-12 bomb is at the Air Force Armament Museum. down at Eglin Air Force. It's out front. It's laying out horizontally in front of the museum. The third T-12 bomb is at Pueblo Army Chemical Army Depot here in Pueblo, Colorado, and it's outside the gate. So you don't have to go through the gate to see it. They have a picnic area set out there. They have different weapon systems. There's an Honest John and different things, and it's sitting out there on its nose. So that was a super cloud buster that was going to be dropped from B-36s. It was test dropped from a B specially converted B-29, but anyway, it became outdated. I guess nukes took over the need to have a 43,000-pound bomb. And don't forget besides the Moab bomb, we got the MOP bomb too. We have not used the MOP. The MOP is the Massive Ordnance Penetrator bomb, and it is huge. And we haven't used that in combat yet, but that's a Blue 57B. I think that's the nomenclature for the MOP. Not a lot of people know about the MOP. No more people know about the Moab. And then we've got a new B-61 nuclear bomb. That's a bunker nuclear bunker bomb, buster bomb that's being developed. So I don't know if we'll ever use a nuclear bunker buster bomb, but we got one. And these are all open source information. I'm not telling you anything that's not out there.
Of course, and it's always good to have a couple of those in the arsenal just in case.
Well, we didn't have any during the Gulf War. Like Taji number two, command two-story cut and cover command and control center that was located outside of Baghdad. Now, during the Gulf War, our bunker buster bomb was just a special 2,000 pound bomb. It was a Blue 109B. A Blue 109B is a bomb that's 2,000 pounds, is made out of special hardened steel, and this was our bunker buster bomb. And we dropped 60 Blue 109s, and they're guided on this Taji number two command and control facility and did not damage it at all during the Gulf War. So we were going to do a ground attack. I was myself and another breacher in Delta. It was going to be a Ranger battalion assault, and I was going to be the breacher for one of the bomb blast doors, and my friend Keith Lamb was going to be the breacher for the other bomb blast doors. And we would go in with the Rangers. We would breach the doors. Rangers would take control of the facility, and then Keith and I would blow the facility up from within. So, but what happened with Taji number two is that there was a ammunition war ordnance officer up in Verliment Arsenal in New York. I might not say the arsenal's name right. There's a lot of gun barrels. They had a whole bunch of 8-inch gun barrels there. And this officer thought, one of these 8-inch gun barrels could make it a pretty good bomb. And so he suggested that. And so it was a GBU. And it became the GBU 28B. So that GBU is a guided bomb unit, and it took 28 days to convert it into a bomb. So that's why it was called a GBU 28. And so they we had we test dropped one of those at Eglin, and then we had two of them, and they were in England, two F-111s. One ki and these bombs weighed 4,700 pounds. So he had one on an F-111 on one side of the wing, and he had two conventional 2,000-pound bombs on the other side of the wing to balance it out. And they flew from England to Iraq, last day of the war, and they dropped it. And the first one missed. Second one went in top dead center and detonated and destroyed the bunker. Now, this bunker was really hard. When they built this two-story bunker, they dug a big hole, built a two-story facility, put dirt on top of it, and then they put a concrete slab, reinforced slab on top of that dirt, and put more dirt on it. So that concrete slab was called a burster slab, and that's what would stop the bombs from doing anything. Now, I'm sure that if you were inside that bunker when a 2,000-pound bomb went off over your head, you could feel the ground shock on that. But so that's the GBU-28, and so that was the reason why the MOP was developed, the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, because we were relying on the B-61s to take out this type of target, which were nuclear. And, we weren't going to use a nuclear weapon. So we had no conventional. So the GBU-28B Bunker Buster was also nicknamed the Sodomizer. So just for trivia.
It is cool trivia though. And I don't want to keep you too long, but you're also a member of the Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame. And
Yes.
how many other EOD technicians or specialists are also in that Hall of Fame?
Off the top of my head, I think we have around, and I hope I don't get this wrong, I would say 24. So the Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame, and I could just look it up on my computer. The Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame was set up in 1967. And so it's and so the EOD that have been inducted into the Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame is less than 5%. So we are encouraging EOD people if to recognize somebody that they think should be in the Hall of Fame. Now, the next EOD inductee into the Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame in 2024, I want to talk about this one, is the famous firefighter Red Adair. I don't know if you're familiar. I don't know if people remember the John Wayne movie Hellfighters. That's based on the life of Red Adair. Now, it's not the movie's not truly Red Adair, but it's based on Red Adair. And John Wayne worked with Red Adair on the movie. So, Red Adair. Does that name, Matt, does that name sound familiar with you?
It only does because you sent me like his biography and I read it, but otherwise it wouldn't have rung a bell for me.
Well, Red Adair was, here's the story of Red Adair. He was in the oil well fighting business before World War II and working with a company that were putting out oil well fires when they would have a blowout. And so when World War II happened, he volunteered. He first got inducted into the infantry, but then he volunteered for bomb disposal. His whole goal was to get into Army bomb disposal because he wanted to learn more about how to use explosives and to use to put the explosive, using explosives to snuff out oil well fire. Just like you blow out a birthday cake candles. You can use the air blast from explosives to blow out on the flame on an oil well fire. And that's what they were using. They were using like nitroglycerin-based dynamite to blow out oil well fires. So he volunteered for Army bomb disposal. So he was in the 139th Ordnance Bomb Disposal Squad separate. He first was assigned to the Philippines. And then his unit was assigned to Japan after Japan surrendered. I think it was August 15th, 1945. But we didn't sign the treaty in Tokyo Bay until September 2nd, 1945. But the so we started occupying Japan, Army of Occupation. Well, they knew that there were some 16-inch guns. At this time, Red Adair was a staff sergeant. They knew there were 16-inch guns overlooking Tokyo Harbor. So we had, the Missouri, other ships, U.S. fleet in Tokyo Bay. We had British ships. We had Dutch ships. We had all of our allied ships that were involved in the Pacific fight against Japan in Tokyo Bay. Now, there were some people in Japan, particularly the people in the Japanese army, that disagreed with the Japanese surrender. They even tried to stop the recordings being sent over the Japanese radio of the emperor announcing the surrender, unconditional surrender. So the day before September 2nd, his team went up to and these guns overlooking the harbor, and they destroyed the guns, the breaches of all the guns overlooking Tokyo Harbor using shaped charges. And so that's his contribution during World War II. So he went back and he formed the company that, well renowned for going all over the world putting out oil well fires. So if you want to see the movie Hellfighters with John Wayne, you'll get a good idea what's all involved in putting out oil well fires that are out of control. Now, John Wayne personally did not think that the movie did Red Adair justice. And he was going to do a new movie, documentary or docudrama, however you, more on his life, Red Adair's life. But John Wayne passed away before he could do that. But that was a goal of John Wayne. Now, during the Gulf War, the Iraqis set all these oil wells on fire in Kuwait and stuff like that. And so President George Bush, personal friend of Red Adair's, they're both Texans, contacted Red Adair and his company and asked him if they would put out those oil well fires. And so Red Adair's company went over there. Now, they figured, I forget how many fires they were. I did in my write-up, I nominated Red Adair. In my write-up, I said how many oil well fires there were. There was a lot. They figured it'd take 5 years to completely do the job. Red Adair's company, and there were other companies that were involved from other countries. They did in 5 months.
Wow.
Put those oil well fires out. So Red Adair, has and his wife have since long passed away. Red Adair's daughter and son have passed away, but he has his grandchildren, and they will be present next May at the Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame at Fort Gregg Adams to honor their grandfather, which is a great honor. So that's going to be our next one.
That's amazing. Did you like were you the one that like spearheaded bringing attention or awareness to him?
I knew of Red Adair and I knew of his time in the army. I didn't know very much. I was actually contacted by the Ordnance Corps Hall of Fame and asked if I would research and nominate him, which I did. And I was lucky enough to re and I did this all without trying to find a next without knowing the next of kin. And since then, once his nomination was approved, the commandant of the Ordnance Corps wanted to personally notify his granddaughter of his selection into the Ordnance Corps. So it was at that time I did a more had a friend who was good on Facebook help me find her and contacted her through Facebook. I'm not on Facebook, but a friend I knew, he did that and was able to make contact with her. And he's also being inducted to another Hall of Fame, to Texas Oil and Gas Hall of Fame. So I was contacted by those people looking for next of kin, which I linked them up to. So yeah, Red Adair is getting recognized.
That's amazing. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think is important to add?
I can't think of anything, but I people that listen to this podcast, if there's people that would write into you or contact you and say, "Well, I want to know more about this or that," we could see if we can work something out that, if I have any background in that, whatever they're interested in. I think I covered it all. I hope I did adequate for the other services.
Hey, this is Matt. This concludes episode 38 with Mike Vining. Please share this podcast with a buddy, mentor, or colleague. New episodes Thursday nights.